more movement at the garages. The smiling one was out there again, babbling to the freakish thing that tended the vehicles. Ayar kept watching the place. This was it, the center of all the Tuscan's problems. The air shaper had shown Ayark the way. And soon, Ayark would lead the rest of the Sand People to her.
Keep going, I'm listening.
Annalene wasn't listening, but it hardly mattered. While Ulbrich spent far more money at the store than any other visitor to the Peak Oasis, and far more time, too. Ulbrich had a platoon of farmhands to run his spread. He knew in his heart that droids were thieves, programmed by Jawas to steal from their masters. The old moisture farmer had first pontificated on that subject when Annalene was running the counter at 17. 20 years later, he was still talking about it, among countless other topics. At the moment, Ulbrich was on another classic. The four times he had seen rain.
"And the second drop was right in my eye, let me tell you. I felt it, and I was looking up, too. You'd think rain would be like the mist some see on the ground, steaming up. But no, it comes right down at you, just like it fell out of a freighter."
"Uh-huh. Right." Annalene nodded as she dusted the merchandise on the shelves behind the counter. Ulbrich's ramblings were like recordings of familiar songs, arranged in a different medley each day. Because while the old farmer remembered a lot, he often forgot his place. An engineer who visited the Dune Sea years earlier once described Ulbrich's stories as transcendental loops defying the laws of physics and storytelling. She didn't know about that, but she did suspect the cause of her pain. Ulbrich's wife, Magda. Annalene had never seen the woman. But it was clear she dispatched her husband to the store at the crack of dawn every morning to torment someone else for a change. This made Magda both a wise woman in Annalene's ledger and deserving of a smack in the face should they ever meet.
"But you know, I swear I seen a freighter take off once and go right through a flock of Nibre, and the things just hit the ground like sacks of spanners. Which is why I don't go near that Mos Eisley no more. 'Cause they're always trying to kill people and take their money."
"Uh-huh, right." Annalene looked around, plaintively, for different company. It was futile. The breakfast rush was over. The workers would be in the vaporator fields for hours. The Bizards had left her guest quarters early that morning to return home, anxious to pick up the pieces of their lives. The settlers around the oasis were resilient, as they had to be. Annalene didn't miss the extra burden, but she did miss the baby. Her babies were at work. Jabe had taken the store's light van speeder truck to the dry goods distribution center in Bastine. Callie was out back with the animals. That left her alone with Bomer, the slow-motion Rodian sitting at the luncheonette table considering his calf. She wondered what he saw there sometimes. She slouched against the cabinets and sighed. "Find what you need at Danar's claim," the sign outside read. What she needed was a month away on a lush green forest planet.
"But back then, the first time I was working for real money on a vaporator, I just started crossing circuits. Beginner's luck, they called it. That was the second time I seen rain. Or maybe it was the first. I spent the rest of my days trying to figure out just what I did."
Annalene looked up. Orin entered through the back of the store, whistling and wearing the natty dress brown she picked out for him from the high-end catalog. Clicking his leather boots together, he smiled broadly at her.
"How do I look?"
"Like you just landed from Coruscant," she said, smiling wanly back.
"Thanks to my fashion coordinator."
Orin's expression hardened when he glanced at Ulbrich. Realizing the old man was in mid-rainfall, Orin rolled his eyes and plunked down his satchel.
Got a meeting in Mos Eisley. That new hotel is taking bids for a water supplier.
Annalene nodded.
Since the last commodity bust, Oren had redoubled his efforts to lock in regular purchasers at preset prices. I'll talk to a couple of farms on the way back about joining the settlers' call. Folks who actually care about protecting their assets.
Oren shot a pointed look at Ulbrich, but the old man paid him no mind.
Annalene knew that Oren had tried again and failed again to sign Ulbrich up a week earlier. Turning his attention to the counter space, Oren patted his vest pockets.
Blast!
Forgot your credit pouch again?
Annalene knew this story, too. Oren raised the hinged section of the counter and stepped to the cash box, sealed, as it had been in her husband's day, with the barrel of a blaster pistol inserted into a pair of metal rings.
Annalene watched as Oren removed the blaster and pulled out a handful of credits. He looked at her abruptly.
Oh, I'll leave a...
Forget it. Money in one hand, he placed the other on her cheek and smirked.
Thanks, Annie. Nobody loves me like you do.
You're probably right.
She watched the man leave.
Nobody had ever kept accounts between the two families when it came to the small things. But lately, Annalene had increasingly gotten the sense that whatever she owed Oren for protection and helping to rear her son paled next to the meals, supplies, and petty cash he'd taken out of the store. Still, a sunny nature counted for a lot. And if she wasn't going to begrudge Wal Ulbrich his audience, it was hard to refuse Oren his little liberties, especially now that he was in his big business phase. Drunk divorcee Oren had been a trial years before. The new model verged on blowhard, especially now, as he seemed to be selling in overdrive lately. But that was a definite improvement.
Ulbrich plopped down a bottle of fizz and a credit on the counter.
Say, did I tell you about the first time I saw a crate dragon?
Enough.
Annalene's eyes scanned beneath the side counter.
There it was. The tub of goods Ben had left behind the week before.
She'd gone back and forth for days about restocking the shelves with the material. Now, opening the window behind her, she decided to do something else.
Callie!
Annalene leaned out the window. Her daughter was behind the store, in the livestock yard.
Callie, can you hear me?
No.
Can you watch the counter for a couple of hours?
No.
Great. Come on in.
Annalene shut the window and pulled the tub from beneath the counter. She was looking in the little mirror behind the kitchen door when Callie appeared from the back, a sodden, sullen mess. Annalene threw her daughter a rag.
Clean up. I need you to work the till.
Do I have to?
Callie glared at her mother. You have something better to do?
I'm mucking out the dewback pen.
The girl peered in at Ulbrich, who was now nattering away to the hapless Rodian.
So the answer is yes. Sorry, sweetie.
Annalene stepped out from behind the door. Her hair was pulled back in a bun, and she was wearing her light cloak and hood.
I need to run to Arndt Thout to see a man about some Dricklefruit.
Dricklefruit my eye? I know where you're going.
Stepping behind the counter, the girl watched her mother pick up the tub of goods.
You're the one that said nothing good ever comes from the Jundland Wastes.
Hush, Annalene said, already to the exit. I'll be back before lunch.
Callie's voice went up two octaves.
Tell Ben I said hello.
The whir of a land speeder sounded outside, and Ulbrich reappeared at the counter before Callie, continuing his winding tale. He didn't even seem to notice that he'd switched Cowwells.
Chapter 13.
If not for the sound, she would have driven past it. White on white under the climbing suns, the squarish hut with its poor stone dome neatly blended with the Jundland Wastes.
Only when Annalene banked the X-31 along the desert floor did she see the glint from the vaporator out back. The hut squatted low on a southwestern bluff. Likely, she figured, situated over a cave. Another last-ditch lodge. The term was fully pejorative, referring to frontier dwellings built on the theory, never proven, that the uplands of the wastes yielded more condensation at night. No one knew for sure, because even the hardiest farmers seldom lasted more than a season. These were places for grubbers on their last chance, and would-be wizards who just knew they had magical combinations of vaporator settings no one had ever thought of before. The whole thing was ludicrous to Annalene. Assuming anyone hit it lucky, what investor in his right mind would build an industrial farm out here? Crazy. She wasn't crazy, though, to pick this direction. Annalene had seen Ben head out from the oasis days earlier, and Orin had reported meeting him out this way. After the past airless week, a hint of a trail still existed. Now she spotted Ben's Yopi quivering out front, less worried about her approach than the noise from out back. Annalene parked the speeder and reached into the rumble seat. That had been an invention of Danar's, ripping out the back of the middle console to make room for the younglings, or in this case, Ben's tub of supplies. Realizing what the sound was, she suppressed a laugh as she walked the goods up the hill.
"All right," Ben called out from behind the house. "I take your meaning. You're upset. You can stop now."
A mountain of hair, easily his match for height, backed up and charged again, horns first, into the side of Ben's hut. Annalene propped the tub on her hip and watched with a barely concealed smile.
"Having a problem with your bantha?"
"No, no. Why do you ask?"
Ben gripped a rope and tried to get the calf's attention. He'd been at this a while, Annalene saw. His blousy white shirt was dingy, and sweat dripped from dark blonde hair exposed to the sky. The animal snorted angrily and returned to its mission. She pointed to the rope.
"What are you planning to do with that?"
"I'm considering hanging myself."
He looked up at her, exasperated.
"I don't know what I did to set it off. Normally, I'm good with animals."
"Well, as you saw with Callie the other day, they're still animals," she said, setting down the tub.
"Forget the rope. Let me have a try." He gestured indifferently.
"Be my guest."
Annalene removed her gloves and strolled toward the massive creature. Raising animals isn't like raising teenagers. Kids don't know what they want, and they want it now. Animals, on the other hand, usually do know what they want. Like this guy, she said, edging toward the bantha calf.
"He thinks your house is his mother."
"His mother?"
"Yep."
Feeling the steaming breath of the wild behemoth, Annalene reached out gently and touched the calf's face. The bantha stamped its feet impatiently.
"Mama's probably wandered farther up into the wastes. He can't find her."
"If you had this much hair over your face, you might lose your way too."
"To a bantha calf, everything that's bigger than food is probably mom. A good rule of thumb."
Ben crossed his arms and watched with concern as Annalene inserted herself fully between the animal and the battered wall.
What do I do?
"Shh."
Annalene traced the calf's eye sockets with her fingers. Leaning forward, she nuzzled its face. The bantha's hooves stilled. The woman whispered to Ben,
"You are going to watch me point him somewhere else."
Ben stood back as Annalene strode forward, pushing the young bantha by the horns. It outweighed her by a metric ton at least, and yet it was backing down the hill. At the foot of the bluff, she turned it to one side and gave it a swat. Long, shaggy hair swaying, it moseyed off.
"Won't he die out there?"
"Nah."
Annalene pulled a handkerchief from inside her boot and rubbed her hands. He won't be alone that long. If he doesn't find his herd, he'll find a Tuscan to adopt, she said.
Ben nodded.
My house thanks you. I did try, well, to calm it. It's all right. You were probably its first human.
Annalene caught a trace of a smile before the man turned and started back up the hill to his house. Ben's expressions in the store had been happier, she thought. Here, he seemed a little downcast.
It must be depressing, living alone so far out here.
He looked back at her.
Why are you here, Annalene?
Special delivery.
Walking with him, she pointed to the tub of goods.
Most of our thieves take things without paying. You're the only person I've met who paid and left his stuff.
I'm a very poor thief, then.
Ben moved the bin into the dubious shade of the vaporator. He scratched his head.
I'm sorry for the trouble of the other day. I hope there weren't any damages. I should be apologizing to you.
It's a friendlier store than that, she said. When I didn't see you again, I was afraid they'd scared you off.
Ah.
Ben looked around.
No, I've been busy.
To Annalene, this side of the house looked like bazaar day for the Jawas. Lots of gear sitting around and gathering sand. And while the doorway to the house was here, the door was not. The burlap curtain she'd sold him hung across the entrance.
The former residents left me with a work in progress, Ben said.
A while ago, it looks like.
Yes. I'd thought to build my own home, but that's more involved than I'd expected, he said.
But there seems to be no shortage of abandoned buildings.
You should at least get a door.
Ben looked amused.
Are you trying to sell me something else?
Just afraid you're going to freeze at night.
A lot of this stuff needs to be inside, in fact.
She walked toward the EOP pen.
And you need to get a tarp over this feed, or it'll be baked in an hour.
Will the EOP care?
No, but you might if you have to live around her.
Ah.
Ben craned his neck.
I was just putting a tarp over my funnel plants.
No, those need to breathe.
They won't get drier than they already are.
Then everything balances out, he said, lifting the cover from the gritty foliage.
I was afraid of a sandstorm.
Then you've seen one before.
Anyone who has would be afraid.
But no. If you see the rock hornets start to swarm, then you can worry.
They beat the forecast half the time.
Ben nodded.
Home delivery and the weather report. This is fine service. It's how I maintain my monopoly. I keep my customers alive.
She pointed to the hood sewn to the collar of his shirt.
For example, if you're going to keep working out here, I'd put that up before double noon.
He laughed.
I did survive before I met you, you know.
But he dutifully donned the cowl. Annalene smiled.
Just looking out for you.
Ever hear of Jelly and Broom?
No.
There's a reason for that.
She reached for the canteen strapped around her shoulder and offered it to him. When Ben declined, she took a swig and continued.
Brune was a great Holovid actor when I was a kid. My mother loved him. Anyway, he came to Mos Espa for some race story he was acting in, and he caught the bug. Fell in love with the desert. The guy was raised in total privilege, and he sets eyes on the Jundland wastes and becomes obsessed.
Annalene cocked her head over her shoulder toward the rocky hills and snorted.
I can't imagine why.
Continue.
So Brune buys a dump out here, no offense, and tells people he's doing research on his own production, a desert epic. And off he goes.
Ah. And no one ever saw him again.
Yes and no.
Hmm. He survived all right.
Showed up in Bastine 6 months later looking 20 years older.
The suns and the wind ripped him up something awful.
It looked like someone taking a plast torch to his face. His own agent didn't recognize him, and his studio wanted nothing to do with him. She pointed to the Eope munching away, its head under the tarp, now covering the trough.
Take it from Rue. Keep your hood on, or you'll dry out like a sack of gore millet.
They said nothing for a moment. Finally, Ben picked up his tub of goods and started toward his doorway.
So are you an actor?
She asked. Ben chortled.
No.
Not out here painting pictures? Not writing about life in the desert?
Or in general?
Ben drew back the curtain just enough to set the supplies inside. He closed it before she could see anything.
No, there is nothing to tell. I am really quite uninteresting. Except to wayward banthas.
Right. Thanks for the supplies. I won't put you to such trouble again. Ben turned toward the debris-laden yard.
Now, if you'll excuse me, I have much to do. How long are you staying?
Ben stopped in his tracks and gave her a look. A look, she thought, that said in the most pleasant but firm way that the interview was over. Annalene backed down the slope toward her landspeeder.
Well, you know where we are if you need anything. And I almost forgot. 4 days from now, there's a big race at Mos Espa.
If you'd like to see what the store looks like without so many rude idiots around,
that's your chance.
She looked keenly at him.
People depend on one another around here. It's no place to live alone.
Atop the rise, Ben cracked a small smile.
To hear you talk, anyone in my care would be dead in 5 minutes. We'll see,
she said, turning back to her speeder.
See you, Ben. If he's hiding, he's new at it, she thought, settling into the driver's seat.
In her years of running the store, Annalene had seen her share of people trying to disappear. From spouses, from Republic Justice, from the huts. There had even been one runaway from a traveling circus. One thing she'd noticed. In an area where everyone knew everyone else's business, the more nondescript someone tried to seem, the more curious the neighbors became. You needed a label, so people could forget about you. She'd always joked that when her kids finally drove her to run to the hills, she'd become known as the crazy lady who stewed Minox for dinner. Maybe Ben would figure that out, she thought as the engine revved. But he was certainly failing at shooing away interest. The man looked, well, sad whenever he thought she wasn't looking. Anyone like that just had to have a story. Pulling away, Annalene circled a rock and looked back up the bluff. She saw Ben looking up at the suns and removing his hood. Strange. Back at Danar's claim, the hands from the Galt fields were in and gorging. Jabe was among them back from Bastine. He didn't look up when his mother walked in. She stepped past the diners to the tap to refill her canteen. Two trays balanced on each arm, Callie paused to study her.
You forgot the drickle fruit.
You're the drickle fruit, Annalene said, walking toward the back.
Any messages? One from your daughter, wanting to know what Ben said. He said thanks for the groceries.
Callie rolled her eyes impatiently.
Wanting to know what Ben said about her.
Annalene emerged wearing an apron and looking primly back at Callie.
He said he's happy to know I have a daughter who's such a good and loyal worker and who minds her own business.
Callie swore. Annalene didn't bother to scold her. Seeing Ulbrecht in mid-conversation, she stepped in to clear his table.
So while, where were we? Ayak returned to the pillars exhausted, having seen the airshaper depart the compound before double noon. The marauder had raced to a waiting Bantha, but there was no hope of catching up with the landspeeder. The airshaper's route appeared to match her hairy-faced rescuer's path from days earlier. It was a reasonable assumption that she had gone to see him. Perhaps they were spouses after all. more useful information. A Yark had intended to tell the others on returning. The Tuskens did not have war councils. It was not the way of Sand People to discuss and connive. Tuskens were so single-minded of goal, so similarly driven, that little coordination was necessary. They moved as a single entity. The only need for words was in sharing information about a target. With that, they would all know what to do. But a surprise waited in the shadows beneath the towering rocks. A gathering was underway, without a Yark. A Yark recognized the low grunts of Gurkar, oldest remaining member of the tribe.
"The Omen is good,"
the old fighter was saying, clutching the horn of a young bantha calf.
"Bounty comes to us. The time is right. What animal is this?"
An incensed Yark demanded, barging into the circle.
"And who told you to speak without me?"
"I did,"
barked another Tuscan, huge and dominating. Harak was a recent addition, the last mighty survivor of another tribe.
"No one needs to hear the words of a Yark to know what to do."
The one-eyed Tuscan ignored the brute. Harak had never accepted a Yark's role in the group, convinced his own size and strength meant all. A foolish belief. The dewback the airshaper rode had been huge, and yet it yielded to the Sarlacc. Sometimes it was better to lie in wait.
"The calf. It wandered here."
Old Gurkar measured the beast's hair.
"The calf should be given to your son, Wily One. A Deenus Tuscan now."
"No," a Yark said, paying no mind to the reference to the boy.
"Not this panther."
There was something wrong about it. A Yark could tell. Tuscans and their banthas were one being, some said. A Yark thought that was idle nonsense. But a warrior who did not understand his mount would not live long. A Yark stepped closer. The calf stamped nervously. There was something familiar about the animal. No, not the animal, the warrior thought, reaching out and grasping a clump of its hair. The creature squealed but did not move.
"The air shaper has touched it,"
a Yark said, releasing the bantha. The scent of the woman was plainly there, just as it had been on the wind that day on the pitted field. A murmur went through the circle.
"Then it should die,"
Harak said, lifting his Gaderfi.
"No."
A Yark stood between the bantha calf and the others.
"The human touched this calf today. She might have a bond with it."
The statement disquieted the group. Gurkar spoke haltingly.
"A Tuscan bond?"
The airshaper rode a dewback. "It died. She may have come here seeking a new mount." A Yark paused, working it out.
"The airshaper may think as we do."
"Enough,"
Harak said, pounding his weapon against the stony wall.
"Enough foolishness! We should ride! A Yark says the settlers strike at us from the compound. The compound must be destroyed, and the airshaper slain."
"No," a Yark slapped the bantha, sending it on its way from the circle.
"Kill the smiling one who leads the posses, yes. Even Hairy Face should he appear. But if the airshaper respects the bantha, then perhaps she is no settler. She may join us."
A louder rumble emanated from the gathering. Harak laughed.
"Join us? The airshaper has great powers and may also have a Tuscan heart. How many settlers know the ways of the bantha?"
A Yark looked through the rocky towers to the north.
"If no one else at the compound has the power of the airshaper, then yes, certainly we seize her. She learns our ways, she lives. If not,
We will learn her powers, one way or another, and she dies.
You make a mistake, Harak said, the hulking warrior's voice booming. You think of the Utman, the Outlander who once joined your clan. That was long ago, and the Outlander is dead. His gods failed him. All gods fail,
Ayark said, arms crossed.
The shadows of failure follow every living thing. Gods are no different. You do not lead,
Harak said, voice dripping with disdain. Both hands on his weapon, the behemoth threatened the smaller warrior.
Enough of this.
Ayark looked coolly up at Harak and called out,
Adin!
From the caves where the younglings carved the dinner meats, Ayark's son appeared.
Yes, honored parent. You did pass the test, child.
I am Tuskin.
The shrouded youth lifted his Gaderfi proudly.
That is well,
Ayark said. A moment later, the one-eyed warrior's arm shot upward, catching Harak beneath the chin. Another moment later, the others saw the knife lodged in Harak's throat. Harak dropped his Gaderfi and stumbled backward, gagging. Ayark kicked the warrior in the groin, knocking him to the ground. A few seconds more work and Ayark rose, blackened blade in hand.
Gurkar looked at the body and fretted. We cannot spare any warriors, Ayark. One was born. Another died. All is equal.
Ayark looked back.
Adin, you will need a bantha. Take her axe.
The old raider objected.
But the bantha should die with its rider. It's our tradition.
Many traditions are dying,
Ayark said, wandering off into the darkness of the pillars. Night was falling.
There was much to plan.
Meditation. Good morning, Qui-Gon. Quiet here as always. I know there are seasons on this planet, but I'm still not sure which one I'm in. But it is peaceful. You know, we trained ourselves to be able to find solace even in the busiest places. Coruscant teemed with souls, and we meditated right at the center of it. By comparison, you'd think this place would be ideal for meditation. I can't tell you why it isn't. You used to say that in cases like this, the problem wasn't the place, it was the person. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do about that. It's not as though I'm going to be any less worried about things after I've been here 6 months. Or 6 years, or however long it takes for hope to return to the galaxy. It's not like I'm going to suddenly get my friends back. It's not like I'm going to feel any better about what I had to do to poor Anakin. It's not like... No, I'm sorry. I don't feel like doing this right now.
Chapter 14.
The Republic. For 1,000 generations, it had been out there. The bright center of the galaxy, shining light into the imaginations of everyone who lived on the Outer Rim. The Republic had seen tumult and change, invaders and oppressors. It had resisted the incursions of armored nomads and crazed cultists. It had even turned its back on the rest of the galaxy for a time, protecting itself against a dark age of fear and plague. But light had always returned. Weeks earlier, someone in the store had told Annalene that the Republic had changed yet again. She hadn't paid much mind. The bright center for her meant Mos Eisley, the large spaceport in the distant east, a bustling metropolis that made the capital Bestine look like the farming community it really was. Annalene liked visiting Mos Eisley, despite its well-deserved reputation as a den of criminal activity. And on a day as slow as today, she would have found some business excuse to go. But Jabe and Callie were both in Mos Espa, as was practically everyone else. The Comet Run pod race was no Boonta Eve classic, but it emptied the Pika Oasis as efficiently as the plague. Glomer had shut down the garages and left with his crews. Most of the independent mechanics, normally willing to profit from his absence, had followed suit. Callie had rented half the livery animals to racegoers. And naturally, Oren had given his vaporator crews the day off. His workers already spent so much time in the claim that Annalene wondered if any of them could tell the difference between work days and holidays anymore. Danar's one criticism of his best friend had been that Oren confused popularity with profit. He made money, but he also spent a lot to look like a big man, too. Annalene would never be accused of making that mistake. She gave no thought to closing the store. The revelers would return in a spending mood, whether they'd won their bets or not. The evenings following races were the most lucrative in the store's year. She'd cover her month's expenses before last call. But the race days themselves were quiet. Annalene had shared a quiet breakfast with Lily. Annalene had actually sat at a table for a change. Afterward, the Zeltron woman headed home, where she planned to lie in a luxurious coma all day until her family's return. Annalene gave old Ulbrich unlimited access to the Bantha jerky jar with instructions to tell Herbally Napti, should she come by, that the store's owner had emigrated to Heptuine. Finally, after supplying Bomer with a full carafe of calf, she grabbed her floppy hat and satchel and stole into the southwestern yard. There she sat on a blanket in the shade of the store's mammoth vaporator, her back against the machine's frosty base, feeling every puff of cool air that wafted off the compressor. Data pad on her lap, she looked at the images and imagined. In seconds, she was sitting on the coast of Barunda, a place alive and teeming with nature. Or capital K on Aquilaris, watching the sea croppers bring in their catch. Or on the gold beaches of Corellia, or some other locale. It was an old data pad, one she hadn't looked at in years. She thumbed again through the pictures. More faraway places, distant both physically and into the past. The hollow emitter on the device didn't work anymore, but she didn't care. The collection of pictures was a hopeless wish list, collated by a much younger person. The planet still existed, for sure. She doubted Chancellor Palpa, who's it, or anyone he was fighting, had the power to change that. But the places were impossibly beyond her reach. She'd brought the data pad outside to refresh her memory about those distant places. Ben had gotten her thinking again about the galaxy. Well-traveled company always did. She'd hoped to ask him if he had been to any of the worlds in her pictures. But the morning had passed with no Ben. It had been silly to expect him to come, Annalene thought. The man had already bought most of what he needed, and a lot of the prospector types could stay out for weeks at a time. Or perhaps he'd forgotten her mention of the day. Or maybe he was at the races himself. She rejected the last possibility. That would make Ben like everyone else here, and thus far, he hadn't seemed like that. But she had to admit she had no idea what he might do. Once again, she mentally calculated the time to traverse the distance from Ben's house to the oasis on Eopiback. Why didn't the man have a land speeder? Just another mystery. But little puzzles were all that separated one day from another at the claim. Sadly, this puzzle seemed doomed to have only 3 or 4 pieces. Doomed. This was the right data pad for thoughts like that. Annalene shifted back to another document and read. She had written it such a long time ago, it almost seemed scripted by another person. My name is Annalene Thaney, and I would like to tell you about myself. She hadn't been Annalene Thaney in nearly 20 years. It had been that long since she'd written anything but a bill of sale. And what she read now aggravated her. The words were written by a child about a child, or rather, about a grown-up who would never exist. Annalene grew increasingly disgusted with each paragraph until finally she reached her breaking point. She stood and turned to the right, where a sand berm had piled up behind the vaporator. Grasping the data pad in one hand, she twisted her torso and hurled the device. The data pad spun like a discus, sailing over the dune and out of sight. Annalene plopped back down on the blanket, satisfied and ashamed in equal parts. It was an old device, rarely used, and what was on it was of no use to anyone. Let the Jawas have it. But suddenly she realized she'd never heard it land. "Lose something?" Ben said. The cloaked man stood atop the dune, with the suns high behind him, and the Eopi at his side. In his right hand, he held the data pad. Annalene stumbled as she tried to get up.
"Sorry," she said, quickly recovering her composure. "I hope I didn't hit you with that."
Ben held up the data pad, amused.
"Obsolete model?"
"Obsolete life," Annalene said, grinning. "And I can sell you 10 better data pads than that."
"I wouldn't have use for them, I'm afraid."
Ben smiled politely as he stepped into the shade behind the vaporator. Out of the glare, he glanced at the screen. What he saw made him look again, more closely. He scanned the words. "Educational opportunities, off-world, swift placement." He looked to her, eyes widening.
"Why, this is a university application."
Annalene felt flushed. "Look at the date on it," she said.
"Oh."
Ben's eyes narrowed.
"More than 20 years ago,"
he said. "It's from after my father lost most of his ranch.
Not long after I had to go to work for Danar.
Back then, I still had my sights set on working with animals."
"A zoological expedition authorized by the University of Alderaan,"
Ben read aloud.
"Traveled 10 worlds in a 2-year exobiology program."
He looked up at her. "It sounds nice." "For someone." She took off her hat and ran her fingers through her hair. 20 years ago, maybe.
Ben studied it further. "I don't know about that. It looks like they've been offering this program for centuries."
He looked up at her.
"I'm sure they're still running expeditions."
She winced.
No, she didn't want to go over this again, and certainly not with him. Seeming to sense her unease, he deactivated the gadget and offered it. "Don't you want this?" "I threw it away."
She changed the subject.
"So why are you here?"
He straightened and cleared his throat.
"I have actually come for a drink," he said, lowering the data pad.
Annalene's eyebrows rose. "Really?"
"Yes," he said. "I've been having trouble getting my old vaporator into service. But I met Orin Galt the other day, and he had the best water I've ever tasted. I was wondering..."
She smiled.
"Buy the keg, my friend. Buy the keg.
But first," she said, "you should try this." She reached out and took his hand. Her touch startled him. But as she turned him to face the vaporator, he saw what she had in mind. A key sat lodged in a lock.
"Ah,"
he said, watching her open the door.
"This is one of Orin's. What did he call them? His pretormans?"
"Yes," Annalene said, rotating the tap outward to become a spigot. "And it's not Orin's. It's mine. Danar put up the first GX-9 in the Oasis here before he died. Your canteen, sir?" Ben reached into his cloak for his canteen and gave it to her. He watched as she filled and returned it. He steeled himself before drinking the cold water. He gasped nonetheless.
"Amazing,"
he said, rubbing icy lips with the back of his hand.
"It's even better than Orin's, if that's possible."
"Thank my husband."
"I thought
then capped his canteen.
I thought he had passed.
He did. Annalene gestured to the blinking controls inside the open panel.
Danar adjusted this vaporator once, years ago, just fooling around. He got what you're drinking there. We've never changed the settings.
Orin's been trying to replicate them all over the valley.
He took the idea and ran with it. I guess so.
She turned back and gestured to the store. Danar didn't mind. We had enough worries without getting into the farming business. You know what they say. Don't dig for treasure. Sell the shovels. She turned back toward the store, suddenly downcast.
I guess I've been out here long enough, she said.
She beckoned to Rue. Let's get you fed and watered, girl. The animal trotted toward her. Ben watched them for a moment before kneeling to gather her blanket.
I'm sorry to have reminded you about Dana, he said, walking along behind her. Orin said he'd stopped to help people in the desert.
It was just like him, Annalene said, leading Rue to the troughs near the livery. She knelt to tie the Eope's lead to a post and stayed down, lost in thought. Ben studied her in silence.
Wait a moment, he said. It wasn't just 8 years ago, was it?
He looked at her.
It was 8 years ago today.
You're good. She looked up at him. One of our locals was in the Comet Run. We were going to have a big celebration here. Danar had gone to Mos Eisley for something special. She shook her head.
That's crazy, isn't it? Send someone out for fleek eels and they never come back.
Ben stood back, respectful for a moment.
I'm sorry, Annalene. I won't patronize you by saying I know how you feel. Every tragedy is different and personal. But you can take some solace in that he was committing a selfless act.
Well, Ben, that's just it, she said, eyes glistening. It's fine to sacrifice yourself if no one else has claim to you. Danar belonged to us, and we never gave him permission to die.
Her forehead crinkled, and she tightened the knot on Rue's lead.
Ben seemed taken aback.
Noticing she stood and offered a weak smile. It wasn't good business to depress the customers.
Sorry, it's just the day, she said. I could leave if it's... No, no, she said, taking the blanket from his hands. I've usually been alone on this day. Used to think it was better. And yet I invited you,
she did not say.
Maybe it's time for a change.
He regarded her for a moment and then brightened, the clever smile reappearing.
You know, why not? I think perhaps we both could use a change of pace for a day.
You have a pace? She laughed.
I don't even know what you do. I solve problems.
Ben prodded her toward the side door of the store. And for this problem, I propose a strategy of mutual distraction, in which you regale me with an expert discourse on the flora and fauna of Tatooine over lunch.
I know just the place nearby. I've heard a lot about it.
I'd better not have to cook. He held the door open. Never fear. I do amazing things with survival rations.
Chapter 15.
Well, we've determined one thing, Ben. Whatever job you had before you came here, you weren't a cook. But you tried.
I didn't try.
I did, he said, grinning as he took the dishes. It's just what I did wasn't very good. I have a friend who's quite militant on the subject of trying.
He looked at the remains on the platter with remorse.
Gastro omelets are supposed to be much better than that.
Annalene laughed.
It wasn't that bad. I have another friend who owns a diner, he said, disappearing into the alcove. He'd have fired me on the spot.
Dishes clattered. Annalene rocked back in the chair and laughed again.
Well, Ben has friends, whoever he is. It wasn't hard to see why.
He played the quiet one, but scraping the surface, she found an infectious enthusiasm for all things. Their lunch had lasted an hour and a half, as they'd shopped from the shelves to find what he was looking for, and the repast had spread across two tables. He'd listened intently to her stories of life on the ranch and at the oasis, and now he was doing the dishes. And he was living as a hermit? "Don't feel bad," she said as Ben reappeared. "We didn't exactly have all the ingredients." "You came close," he said, wiping his hands on a towel. "As frontier stores go, this is a supermarket on Coruscant."
"You've been there?"
Ben looked at her for a second, and then over at old Ulbrecht, who let loose with an angry snort. The farmer had been snoring loudly in his chair for hours after having gorged on jerky. Annalene had joked that Magda Ulbrecht, or his heart doctor, would send over a bounty hunter for him any minute. Ben had laughed, but she'd noticed his slight tension at first meeting Ulbrecht, and for a moment she could have sworn Ulbrecht recognized Ben. But the old man had obviously dismissed the thought, because after that he paid Ben no mind. Which was, Annalene thought, a lucky stroke for Ben. To Ulbrecht, strangers were either potential thieves or audiences for his stories. Now Ben nodded toward the farmer.
"He looks happy," he said. "I'm happier when he's asleep," she said, rising.
"But don't change the subject."
"What do you mean?" "I mean you've done it again. You've managed to let me talk all through lunch, and you've hardly gotten a word in edgewise." "It's called being a polite guest," he said. "Are you sure you're not wanted for something? No price on your head on Duro for running illicit omelets?"
"No, nothing like that,"
he said, leaning against the counter.
He looked around, taking everything in.
I guess you could say now, I just watch, and this is a peaceful enough place for it."
He looked out the window toward the livery yard.
"What do you think so far?"
"It might seem that there's not much here," he said, "but what there is, there's plenty of."
There was something uncertain in his voice, Annalene thought, as if Ben couldn't yet decide whether he liked Tatooine or not.
He turned back to her.
"Sorry, no offense to your home. Far be it for me to judge something from one pot."
He walked back to the table for more dishes.
"No, you're perfectly safe in judging one part of Tatooine from another," Annalene said, surveying the room. "Grains of sand, settlements, settlers, we're all pretty much the same. It's always been like this, and it's never going to change."
"I try to avoid the words always and never,"
Ben said, taking the cloth to a plate that was already clean.
His tone grew solemn. "Things that seem permanent, a given, have a way of changing quickly to something you don't recognize. And not all change is for the better." She studied him closely. Pleasant on the outside, torn up on the inside. Many of the people in her life were the opposite. You had to get through layers of abrasiveness to find the niceness in them, if it existed at all. Maybe this was the key to the man. "Did something happen to you, Ben?"
"No,"
he said, looking at the dish. Almost under his breath, he added, "Not to me."
Abruptly, he turned away and began wiping off the tables they'd sat at. He stepped gently past Vollmer, who still sat motionless at his solitary table with his beverage. Brightening, Ben regarded him with admiration.
"Now here's someone who knows how to watch."
Vollmer's focus hadn't changed, still on the steaming cup.
"I never know what he sees there," she said. "I don't even know why he comes in every day."
She wondered sometimes what sadness was in the Rodian's life.
"Do you speak any Rodian?" Ben asked.
"I'm not sure he does. All these years and I don't know anything about him."
She cocked an eyebrow at Ben.
"I guess it's contagious."
Ben looked at the chrono on the wall.
"Well, I should buy my keg of water and go,"
he said. "Your race fans will be back soon." He walked to the stack of transparent drums in the corner. Lugging one of the large containers down, he turned and fished for credits in his cloak. Watching him count, Annalene spoke up.
"Hey, wait," she said.
She started toward the door to the garage.
"Meet me outside, okay?"
Ben looked back at her, puzzled.
"I should really be getting... Just trust me. I'll be just a second."
Ben stood with his keg on the stoop outside the store. A garage door opened, and Annalene's old X-31 emerged, with her at the controls. She parked it next to him and debarked.
"Everyone's not due back for a couple of hours," she said, reaching for the water container.
"I'll drive you."
"That's not necessary." "No, it'll be fine," she said, lifting.
"We'll go around to the livery and put Rue in the rumble seat."
"Will she ride there?"
"My kids did. So we know it holds wild animals." Ben looked back, seemingly troubled.
"Really, you don't have to do this. It's been a fun afternoon. Something I didn't know I needed.
But you can't leave the store empty."
"It's just Ulbrich and Bomer in there. I think it's safe."
Annalene gave Ben a look that exuded confidence. She'd gotten him to relax. She wasn't about to let him ice up again. She reached out with her hand, only barely aware of a high, distant whine on the air.
"It's all right, Ben. I'm just saving you some time. Come on."
The sound grew louder, and Ben's eyes widened, suddenly serious. He grabbed her arm.
"Annalene, look out!"
She saw it just for an instant, out of the corner of her eye. A copper-colored shape rocketed around the corner of the garage. The vehicle clipped her parked land speeder where it hovered, sending it spiraling. In the same second, Ben threw his body into hers, knocking her off her feet. The two of them hit the sandy ground together. The world above went black as the underside of the careening X-31 whipped over them. The land speeder slammed into the sinstone outer wall of the building with a colossal crack. Ben rolled free, wary and alert. Annalene sat up, bewildered. Her land speeder sat on the ground, a short distance from the garage entrance. The vehicle's right side was dented. Its left engine hung off, lopsided. And behind Ben, she could now see the cause. Vika Galt Sportster, its nose smashed and half buried in the sand. Behind the controls, dazed, sat the young woman herself. And in the passenger seat, Jabe! Annalene sprang up, overcome with worry, but on reaching the wreck, her expression changed. Her son looked up at her and giggled uncontrollably.
"Hi, Mom! We're home!"
She could smell the cheap lum ale the hut served at the raceway.
"Are you kidding me?"
Her eyes darted to Vika, similarly inebriated. Annalene scrambled across the crushed hood of the vehicle to reach her.
"Vika!"
The young woman looked at the shopkeeper lunging toward her and burst into giggles herself.
"Mama's JV is all right," she said in a syrupy voice. "But you should have parked somewhere else. It's race day."
"Where's your father?" On cue, two more land speeders arrived, hurtling around the corner of the garage building. The first, driven by Zed and Mullen, nearly caused another collision. Behind it, Orin's silver land speeder arrived in a more orderly way. Callie was driving, as Orin chatted over the seat to a trio of horn-headed Deveronian males. Annalene recognized them as the business contacts from Mos Eisley he'd been desperate to impress.
"We're in the holy compound now, folks," Annalene heard Orin say to them as they stopped. "Kick the sand off your shoes and genuflect as you enter."
Stepping out of the vehicle, he saw Annalene's wrecked speeder first, and then her, charging toward him.
"Uh-oh." "Look!" Annalene sputtered, arms waving.
"Look what they did!"
Orin walked up to the Sportster. Vika and Jabe tumbled out, rocky on their feet, but otherwise unharmed. He looked them over and then glanced at the battered wall of the garage. He whistled.
"Looks like another lap at Mos Espa," he said loudly.
The Deveronians laughed. Annaline wasn't amused.
"Your daughter was drunk and driving my son."
"The race ended early," Warren said.
"This one did. Is that your idea of an explanation?"
Warren closed the distance with her.
"The race was flagged to a stop halfway through. Two of the Hutt's teams got into a big brawl. Big disappointment."
He shifted to a quieter voice and gestured toward the store. "Everyone's going to want drinks, Annie."
"Everyone's been drinking, or hadn't you noticed?"
She turned to see Jabe trying to edge his way toward the store. She pointed at him with a force that could have knocked him down.
"And don't you think of moving!"
Annaline turned back on Orin, who was clearly uncomfortable with the scene playing out before his wealthy customers. She didn't care.
"Orin, Jabe is not an adult. I said he could go to the races if you watched him. You call this watching?"
Orin put his hands up before her.
"Annie, you know these trips are a rite of passage for these kids. And besides, this is Tatooine. A body that works all the time is pretty grown up, no matter what the age. Isn't that right?"
Before Orin could get whatever support he was expecting for his argument, a high female voice carried over all the others. Callie, who at first had been spellbound by the wreck scene, had suddenly noticed someone at the periphery.
"Ben!"
Forgotten by Annaline since the crash, Ben had stepped up to check on Jabe, earning a bad look from the boy, which made four, as Ben was getting them now from Vika, Mullen, and Zed as well. Callie's greeting was as enthusiastic as theirs was hostile, and Orin's was different altogether.
"Oh, hello, Ben,"
Orin said mildly, after the surprise registered. He looked back at Annaline, eyebrow raised.
"You two were here all day?"
Ben stepped backward toward the wreck of the landspeeder.
"Really, I just stopped by for water."
Orin saw the bashed keg, its precious contents on the ground and evaporating. He saw his ranch's label there and smiled.
"You liked it then?"
Suddenly elated, Orin pushed past Callie and took Ben by the shoulder.
"This is wonderful! Ben, there's folks I'd like you to meet."
As Orin pushed him toward the Deveronians, a squirming Ben looked back at Annaline in near panic. She merely shrugged. No force in nature could protect someone once Orin was in salesman mode, and especially not when he had a celebrity endorsement in the making.
"Ben, these people run the Lucky Despot, a hotel, casino, and conference center going in at Mos Eisley."
Orin turned to his guests.
"This man, a big hero around here, by the way, rode all the way in from the wastes just for a drink of Galt Sparkling 7. The best-tasting water in any tap from Tatooine to Tanab."
Ben nodded meekly as the Deveronians enthusiastically shook his hand and chattered about their trip and him. They had many questions.
"Did you really come so far just for the water? Would you go to Mos Eisley for it? How much would you pay by the glass in a posh metropolitan setting? Did you really save the store owner's daughter from a rampaging stampede of banthas, as she told us in the landspeeder?"
Hearing that, Annaline looked at Callie, whose shoulders sank in embarrassment. But Callie's imagination and crush were relatively important. At least Callie was sober, as she always was. Jabe seemed to be steadying, but he wouldn't be for long if he followed Vika inside.
"The bar is closed,"
Annaline yelled. Orin stepped back, waving his hands.
"Wow, don't say that too loudly.
I'm supposed to be showing these people a good time. And they only got to see half a race.
They'll see a murder if your kids get within a light year of my son again.
Oren grasped for her hand. You know I'll make good on the land speeder. Just more work for Glomer.
But I really need this, okay?
Annalene groaned, disgusted.
Fine. I'll serve the Deveronians only. But let me go extricate Ben before he decides to never visit this.
She stopped speaking as she noticed Ben's expression from amid the group of visitors. Oren noticed it too. Something wrong, friend? The man looked back at the store, eyes narrowing. He started to speak when the side door burst open. Bomer appeared in the doorway of the claim, his big dark eyes bulging. He tripped on the stoop and fell forward, revealing the dagger protruding from his back. And the giant Tusken Raider standing behind him.
Chapter 16.
They had approached the oasis from the northeast. The passage had been difficult, but a Yark had studied the problem closely. There was no other way. The warriors had spent 3 days on a long, looping approach from the pillars, stopping only to overnight in quickly erected and, just as quickly dismantled, huts constructed of canvas and bantha ribs. A Yark had made a gambit based on the suns themselves. Whatever their failings, the Sky Brothers' movements were reliable. The accursed shadows told the wise Tusken much, not just the time of day, but also the time of year with great accuracy. And near this day in past years, a Yark had seen travelers making pilgrimages to the northwest, like creatles drawn to a corpse. Was it some sort of rite? A curious raider had followed once, reporting back a great gathering where settlers paid homage to their bloated hut gods with games and spirits. It was vile foolishness to a Yark, who nonetheless saw an opportunity. As larger vehicles began traversing the desert, taking supplies northwest, a Yark had inferred that the next fete day was near. An opportunity to find the oasis lightly defended. The Tuskens had infiltrated the compound in pairs, hiding behind the barn buildings. The structures were large enough to screen the movements of many, and a Yark had brought many indeed. All the warriors had come. The aged, the injured, even son Adin on his first hunt. Only the women and children tending the banthas had remained behind. From a surveillance perch atop one of the barns, a Yark had seen the airshaper and hairy face in the main building. Alone, or close enough. It was perfect. Perfect. Until the first land speeder had appeared from the northwest, early and unbidden. A Yark had recognized the newcomer as the settler vehicle that had arrived first during the assault on the farm days earlier. Two land speeders followed behind, including the shining vehicle of the Smiling One. Undeterred, a Yark had leapt from the rooftop and started the charge. The Tuskens still had superior numbers and surprise. They had caught all their enemies at once. Warriors streamed across the livestock yard toward and into the buildings. A Yark hooted. There was no need for a command. The others knew. Find the airshaper and kill the rest.
Tusken!
Oren pulled his blaster from his shoulder holster. He'd only worn it to impress the Deveronian investors. Now he fired it into the doorway of the claim. The rifle-toting warrior ducked back inside and began returning fire. The Deveronian stood mystified, perhaps thinking the event was a frontier entertainment staged by Oren. That ended,
when one of them took a rifle blast to the chest. Orin screamed for the others to get down with him, using his vehicle for cover. To his right, Zed and Mullen drew their blasters. To his left, Vika and Jabe hid behind the wrecked Sportster. A savage in the compound was a sobering sight, to be sure. Orange fire painted the approach to the building.
Hold your fire!
From his position along the outside wall near the doorway, Ben pointed at Bomer. The Rodian, knife still in his back, was clawing at the dust, trying to pull himself forward, even as the blaster bolts blazed above him. Orin gawked at Ben. Hold fire now? But Ben was already on the move. Whipping off his cape, the man spread it like a net and hurled it toward the doorway in one swirling motion. The Tuscan's rifle bolts followed it upward. Ben dived downward, tumbling across the narrow field of fire. Reaching Bomber's side, Ben took hold of the Rodian and heaved. A second later, both figures were huddled against the sinstone wall, just to the left of the open doorway. The Tuscan blazed away again, raking the place where Bomer had fallen. Hiding behind her downed landspeeder with Callie, Annalene yelled to Orin,
"Don't shoot! You'll hit Ben!"
Orin sent her a plaintive look. Vika and Jabe had retrieved their weapons from her vehicle and were firing wildly. It was clear from the ruckus that the Tuscan in the store was definitely not alone. There was no telling anyone to cease fire, not now. Ben seemed to know he was on his own too, as he struggled to drag the bleeding Rodian back away from the firing zone and toward the nearest garage bay.
There's more!
Mullen yelled, pointing southeast. More Tuscans appeared around the corner of the store, Gaderfi raised. One charged Zed, smashing the massive farmhand in the ribcage. Orin brought the exposed attacker down with a blaster bolt and yelled for Mullen and Zed to fall back. They'd been successfully outflanked. The Sand People were striking from inside the store and from around it. Mullen reached his father's position, gasping,
"The call! Activate the call!" "I left the activator at home," he said, swearing. "We were going to the races."
He looked back to Annalene, behind the nearby X-31.
"Do you have your activator?"
She couldn't hear him. Annalene had found a moment to fish her rifle from her back seat and was angrily blasting away at her uninvited guests. Orin repeated his question, straining to be heard. She looked at him flustered.
"I don't carry the thing around. This is your home base. It's supposed to be safe."
Ben dashed forward from the garage where he'd left Bomer. He slid to a grinding stop behind Orin's landspeeder. Between shots, Mullen looked at him and snarled,
"Next time, bring a blaster. You ain't getting mine."
Ben ignored him.
"Another wave!"
he yelled, and pointed to a new group of Tuscans. Screened by their attacking companions, the newcomers charged across the claimed southern yard toward the giant vaporator. Orin looked through the chaos at them, momentarily confused. That was old number one, the first Praetorian tower in the oasis. The Tuscans were attacking it, clubbing its base with their gaffy sticks. Annalene pointed at the tower's tip.
"It's the call! They're after the call!"
Of course, Orin understood right away. The settler's call used a standard transmitter to connect the subscribing farms and the vigilantes. But there was also the siren. And here, as at the Bizarre Farm, it sat at the highest point in the area.